Good afternoon. My name is Frank Catalano, and this is, what is this? This is writing great characters in the first 10 pages. See what happens when you hit a certain age? I hope you're all having a great time today at the conference. And what we're going to be doing today, what I'd like to do, is I want to introduce myself, just say a few words of who I am. And then I just want to see kind of where you guys are at. And the trend has been mostly fiction writers, but there might be a couple of screenwriters. And in this seminar, we're going to explore, you know, I just want to say this. When you're working in presentation of material, you always have to come up with these kind of nifty titles, you know. And so I want to look at this idea about writing great characters in 10 pages and what that means, what it really means, as opposed to beyond what a title is, okay? And we'll take a look at that today and try and give you kind of a working understanding of how to transition your, if you're already a screenwriter writing actively, how to get better at it, and or if you're a novelist, how to transition what you've done in a novel form or a literature form into writing for the screen. Now, before I begin, I'm going to pass this around, and it's not obligatory. You don't have to do it. It's not mandatory. But if you want to give me your email, I'll probably have an email version of what we talked about today. You know, some notes and stuff, and I can send that to you. And when I do send it to you, you'll have my email address, and you can always email me back and ask questions, anything like that. So we'll start it here, and we'll end it there. Put your, you didn't put your, yours in the last one, right? Put it on, because this is why I have it. Okay. Yeah. Right. Yes. Yes.
Oh.
Well, actually, I parked the cars over here. You know, I was at Warner Brothers for many years, and I'll tell you what I did in a minute. And people would always say, oh, what do you do? And, you know, because they want to know, what did you do? And I used to tell them, and I got really elaborate. I used to park the cars, and after a while, I washed the cars. No, but that's, none of it's true. Anyway, let me tell you what I do. I am a college professor right now. I've been at USC for 34 years, teaching in the School of Theater, and I teach acting and writing and theater, all different kinds of elements of presentational, performance, art, you know, anything like that. And I also teach, which I probably didn't say last time, I teach humanities, which is visual arts, painting, sculpture, film, and I do all of that. And the acting classes I have are both on camera and stage and those kinds of things. And I've produced theater, live theater. I've been at the Beverly Hills Playhouse. I've had shows in New York and places like that. And I've also been at Warner Brothers, quite a few studios. Warner Brothers probably the longest. And I did various things there, consultancies and packaging and marketing and all of that, and writing. I had a first, what they call a first look writing agreement at Warner Brothers, which is actually a fun, it's good and it's bad. The good news is they give you a lot of money to take everything you write, but they're not obligated to produce it. So you set up shop there, and you write, and you get writers, and you work with writers. But, you know, producing is something totally different than that. That's just really kind of a source. But I was there, and I did that. I'm also an author. I have two books out, one which is called Art of the Monologue, which has been out since 2007, and it's a theater book. It's for actors, and it's original monologues and things like that. I've had plays produced, published. I have a new play being published right now, and I have a new, brand new book out coming out that's actually coming out this month, so it's not outside, and it's called The Creative Audience. And it deals with something that I really had been thinking about. And it's actually, we're going to talk about it today a little bit. The role of the audience in the development and collaborative role of the audience in the development of the creative aspect in visual arts and performing arts. So it takes into consideration painting, advertising, but it also talks about film, television, and the internet. How things are created today on the corporate level, almost in reverse. So if somebody comes up with an idea, it's really kind of tested first. Bill Clinton was great at it. I'm sure Barack Obama, George Bush wasn't very good at it. But it, you know, George Bush kind of did whatever he did what he wanted to do. Other leaders, they say, this is the idea. How are we going to present it to the public so that we could get what we want to get? It doesn't mean they lie. It just means that it's how it's packaged. And it's going on right now. I was watching the news. How, if you, depending upon who you talk to, the bailout thing that they're working on, depending upon how you describe that, it sounds great, or you listen to somebody else, it sounds like the worst possible thing you could think of, and so on and so forth. And in writing, especially what you guys are doing, and me, you have the presentation of it is almost as important as the idea itself. And that's what I was thinking of before I came here today to meet all of you. How, what's the best frame to put this in? You know, writing great characters in 10 pages. What does that mean? Think of it this way. We've all probably been to McDonald's or Burger King. I know you have. You probably won't admit it, but you have. And what are you getting? We hope that it's a beef patty, right? Now, we could take that same beef patty and go to a really fancy, like in L.A., we have Wolfgang Puck and all those places. And now you take that thing and you put it, you may change the shape of it a little bit, you know, so it doesn't look like a patty. And then you put some carrots and some other things around it and garnish it. And you put amber lighting and candles and a violin player. And now that hamburger patty that was 99 cents is $100. But what has changed? Nothing. The only thing that's changed is the frame that it goes in. Is it, and in any, and I, this is important to stress, it's not a lie in the sense that I'm not taking out the patty and putting it in my pocket and putting a steak there. No, it's still the same thing. It's the point of view and the framework of the presentation that is the most important thing. The idea remains the same. And for us, writing characters and converting characters from novels and things like that, I want to explore the differences between the two mediums. So with that in mind, how many of you are active screenwriters? I know I've got one. Well, I still have one. I've got two. And you're...
Off and on.
Off and on. But you've written... Have you seen any of your stuff actually go into production?
No, but it's being shot.
Okay. How about you?
Great.
Wonderful. Yeah, but you know what? That's the future. When you go to Warner Brothers and all those places and they go, well, young people aren't doing that anymore. They just go out and they don't know that they're not supposed to be able to do it. And they go out and they make it. And then the discussion is, I have these four films up on YouTube or wherever the, you know, whatever the thing is, and I got 50,000, 100,000 hits, and here it is. On a movie, perhaps, that would have never been made. And, you know, in the writing aspect, and novelists and things like that, we're kind of getting there. I mean, you know, I guess you could post your work and get hits on it, but in the visual medium, that's what people do. They put they shoot scenes, and they put it up, and it's up and running. So what I want to talk about first, about writing great characters in the first 10 pages, that's a catchy title. That's all it is. I'm going to be straight with you. It really should be writing great characters for the medium. No one would come. You know, that's probably why. Because you're saying, all right, the first 10 pages. Let's talk about that. Writing great characters, we all want to do that. That's a given. And we're primarily novel writers, or fiction writers, nonfiction writers, and whatever. You have your characters, and within that medium, you have a certain methodology of development, you know, narrative and all of that. And you can stop in the middle of your story and go into your childhood past of your character and all of these things. In film, and I'm going to break film down for you a little more specific, television, film, internet, those things. You don't have that luxury always. There's that framework that you have in film, if you take feature film, of the expected or audience runtime for it. It's like when you go to the movies, and we all go, what do you think of, if I were to say to you, what is an appropriate, I hate that word, but what is the appropriate or reasonable runtime for a motion picture? In other words, if you're all dressed up, you're walking out the door, and you buy your ticket, and it's 8 o'clock at night, when do you expect to be home? Assuming you don't stop, you know, and eat. Yeah, 10 o'clock. So if you go out, and what about if you're going to the opera? All right. You with me on that one? I went to the Carmen. Placido was doing Carmen. And I went with my daughter, who loves the opera. And I went, you know, it's like act one, act two. And it's, oh, honey, that was great. You know, she says, Dad, it's just the intermission. There's another three acts. Straight to the bar. Okay. Anyway, so there's a certain audience expectation which is somehow attached to the media. Nobody wrote it down. There's not like a little traffic cop there. But this is what we understood. In some of the other seminars I gave this weekend, we talked about the idea that certain media have a certain expectation. And there is some specific evidence, specifically in film. If we were to go back in time to, let's say, 1939, 90-some-odd million people a week went to the movies. And, you know, that was great. It was the American pastime. When you went to that movie theater in 1939, you looked up at the marquee, and it might have said Humphrey Bogart or whatever, but it would say something like a Warner Theater, a Paramount Theater, an MGM Low. What's my point is, the production entity, which was, let's say, Paramount Studios, let's use one of the big five, owned the production of that film. They hired the writer, they made the movie, they distributed the movie, and they own the physical theater. Chivalry is not dead. Where would you like to sit? Why don't you sit right up here?
Come sit over here.
And they own the physical theater, which meant if the movie ran long, they didn't care. If the movie was bad, they didn't care. Of course they wanted it to be good. But it didn't matter because they knew they had 90-plus million people a week going to the movies no matter what. No, seriously. And it was a given. They said, we could put a chicken in there running around and we know we're going to make our numbers. And plus they own the seats. They own the candy. They own the popcorn. Today, Paramount, let's go back to that, owns the studio, owns sometimes the distribution, most of the time, but they don't own the theaters anymore. That's separate. Which means all those multiplexes we go to, they're separate businesses, and because of that, there is always an indelible pressure on production to make shorter films. You knew I was getting around to us eventually. And it has nothing to do with our expectation. It has to do with we want to get as many asses on the seats as possible. So if I've got Theater A and it's got 300 seats, I want to be able to run it five times. And if you come up with a Titanic or a Ring or one of those long Dances with Wolves, I can only do it twice.
Pearl Harbor.
That's right.
Yeah, also they're running more ad time.
Well, yeah, we're not even counting that. We're not counting that. I'm just talking about what we write. All right? And so, and you bring up an interesting point because one of the other things I was talking about, not in this seminar, but in another seminar, I have been to meetings where product placement is an issue. And something would say, the script is horrible, but let's do it because those little fuzzy things will make a lot of money with them. And they figure out how to make it better, which is another story. So there's an indelible pressure in cinema for it to be a kind of, I'm not going to use the word fixed, but a generally fixed runtime, which we don't have in literature. So let me ask you, most of your books, 300 pages, 250, anybody over 300? I think, okay. That's right. You told me that. Anybody over 400?
Yeah,
I love those things. I mean, when you get a good book and it's for you, can just settle in and glide with it. You know you're going to be together for a while, which is great. And so now all of you that have that plus 300 crowd in here, all of you, now you're taking this beautifully written with characters and all the stuff we're talking about, and you got to put it in this little square hole that runs 120 pages thereabouts. So there's a challenge there. And we talked about that in some of the workshops this morning about how you get this large thing and you have to squeeze it into this little thing by picking certain things and choosing, by starting at the end. We did a workshop yesterday about picking the most heightened moment of your book and making that the beginning of your screenplay. So, writing great characters, we're back on the title, we all want to write great characters. We all want to write great stories. Now for the second part of the title. In the first 10 pages, what's that mean? That's just, again, something you put in the title. But there is a little bit of truth to it. Okay? And here it is. We live in a society, and I'm not saying anything I think you don't already know. It's an immediate gratification society. And television and internet and iPhones and all that stuff. We don't want to go through anything. So although you could probably this afternoon list tons of very successful movies that have what I call a slow roll. You know, you just kind of pull into them nice and easy. Most of them, you've got to create the gist or the important things of your script and your story right away. Now let's go a step further if we could. I'm sure some of you went to some of the pitch workshops here. They have pitch workshops, don't they?
Yes. Oh. Yeah.
And now take your wonderful book, and now they're saying, oh, you know, we're interested in your book. Do you have a screenplay? And you go, yeah, I went to this workshop, I had a screenplay. So now you have a meeting. There you are, you're sitting in Burbank, California at Warner Brothers or in Hollywood at Paramount, and somebody's sitting across a desk or around a table, you know, you're kind of hanging. They go, all right, give me your story. And they're talking about, give me your story in a minute. Now we're going from the mode of presentation. We're going from the full meal, which is your book. You're bypassing the screenplay. The screenplay is not even there yet. People say, well, I'm going to write this really phenomenal screenplay. They never get it to be in front of anybody because they miss the pitch. You know, they go, yeah, all right. So I'll tell you a funny story about a pitch. It's not that funny. I guess you had to beat it. I was at Warner Brothers, and I had this young writer, kind of a nerdy guy, but a nice guy. And he got it upon himself to research the transcripts of NASA, the Apollo missions and all of that. And this is all in my book, The Creative Audience. Anyway, he comes up with this theory that the Russians landed on the moon first and that it was covered up. And it's not just an idle thing. He had specific transmissions. Houston, we've got a problem. You know, it was the whole thing. And he was ready. He said, I can show you there are 3 missing cosmonauts, and I can show you when they were launched, and nobody ever heard of them, and blah, blah, blah. And then he added a backstory. So he's ready. This guy's pumped. He goes into this meeting, and he has what I thought was an okay script. It was a good script, but it was not a great script. It didn't have any heat. It had all intellect, but no heat. You know, like when somebody tells you an idea about a conspiracy or whatever, you go, I'm interested, did that really happen and all that. But the character, so it needed a little work. But that was not the fault, because it never got read. At the pitch session, he goes, what do you got, kid? It was something, it wasn't a guy with a cigar, but it really felt that. It's like, all right, kid, what do you got? He goes, here it is. The Russians landed on the moon first, and nobody knows about it. Guy goes, who gives a shit? What else you got?
Whoa.
It was that fast.
Oh,
that's it. Nobody cares. And so I said to myself,
self?
No. I said to myself, that pitch, what was lacking in the pitch, let's blame the little guy, not the producer. It didn't have the spirit of the book. It didn't have it. He cut it down so much that there was no soul left in it. He was not offering him the chicken. He was just offering him a little bone, and it wasn't even interesting. And I don't know. I've endeavored to think about what could he have said that would have been more interesting to do that. But he never got to do the script. Not at that studio. And the point of it was that was what failed there was not the idea, it was the mode of transmission. It was what environment am I in that I'm presenting this idea, and how can I make this idea fit that mode? Is it a hamburger or is it Wolfgang Puck? And they were not in sync. The guy wanted something else. Let's move one step further, if I may. The next mode of transmission, if I can use that word, would be your script. You now are getting a read. You know, producer A, B, C, or D says, I would love to read your script. That's what they'll tell you. Do you think that they read it? No. They take the script and it's given to a reader. So now your life and your creation is now being entrusted into somebody you don't even know. I mean, you don't even know the producer, but now it's being entrusted to someone else. And they analyze it on a level which may not have anything to do with your creative idea. It may be budgetary, like how many of you are doing period pieces? Okay. You know the problem with period, it costs more money. And the thing is, so you may write a brilliant thing, but it may get shot down because they go, oh, we don't want to do any period pieces because we don't want any high budgets. So you look at it and you say, okay, I'm now presenting my work in a mode which a third person's going to read it. That's where the 10 pages comes in. You got to do it right up front. Because let me tell you what they do when you get your script. Hey, thank you for the script. They turn to the last page. They want to know how many pages is it. All right? Now, what does that mean? It means nothing, but it means everything. If you write a script and it's for a feature-length film and it's 120, 115, 130, you're okay. If it's 190, you got a problem, Houston, because they're judging you already. And they know all the tricks. The writers use smaller fonts, you know, they know all that. You know, you use standard font and you hand them 180, 150 page script, it's already got 1 foot in the grave. Because it tells them that you're not familiar with the medium. That's all it means. The next thing they do is they look at your script, and in that first 10 pages, they're judging you. It's like when you meet somebody in a bar or a restaurant. Hey, what do you do? And he goes, oh, well, I'm, you know, I dig ditches. And they're going, loser. You know, how old are you? And, you know, we all do this. It's the code. So they're reading your script, the first 10 pages. No, loser. Oh, that sucks. Oh, that's interesting. I'll stay. Oh, that's bad. And within 10 pages, they're making a decision about your work, about you. And that's the way people are. It has nothing to do with being good or bad. They're all in a hurry. Does it mean that they don't read the rest of the script? They do. But you want to be, it's like I teach acting, right? I always tell my students, you want to be where you need, you need to be at zero when you audition, not below zero. And when you're reading those first 10 pages, you want to be at zero or better. So that they're going, oh, this has got possibilities. I'm reading it. This is good. Oh, this sucks. And then, you know what they do with the back 110? Of your book, of your script, they skim it, you know, they write some things, and you lost. And your best stuff is on page 55, and they skim through it, and they don't get it. And you don't get what you want. So what I'm saying is, I'm a new theory, the older I get, the more I'm into simplicity and all of that. I guess we get that way. But I want the best parts first. And so, yesterday we did a whole hour on starting your screenplay at the end. You know, get the heightened point and shove it right up there on the first 10 pages and get them go, whoa! And then give them the rest of the story as you go. Then you're at the party, they're on the bus, they're on the train, whatever analogy you want to use, and they'll take the journey with you. Now, your script may not make it for reasons that really have nothing to do with the quality of your work. It could be, we don't have the budget, we're looking for a project for A or B, we want this, we want that. You know, but at least you got the read. And I will tell you something, if you get a good reader's report and you go in there and your screenplay does it, your novel is published, you may not get the first one, but you'll get the second one. You know, the next time you submit. So my point here is to front load your work as much as you can. And that's why we say writing great characters in the first 10 pages. In all honesty, no one's counting. No one's counting. If you introduce your character fully by 11 or 12, it's okay. But I mean, think about in the front. Now let's go one more mode. You're in the theater now. Your movie's been made. Your book's been made into a movie. And you're sitting in the theater. Everybody's going, yeah, I wish. A couple of things had to happen. They had to squeeze this 300-page novel or 250-page novel into the screenplay, so choices had to be made what to take, what to not take, and whatever. And now you have it, and now it's been handled by directors It's been handled by an editor can make or break you. You could have the best director in the world. If you have an editor that's like out to lunch, the way it gets put together is bad. So assuming all of it's good, you're there and the credits are rolling and you're watching your movie and the audience is watching it. Within the first 10 minutes, I'm using the number 10 again, within the first 10 minutes of the exhibition of the movie, they should know who the main characters are and something about them. And if they don't, there's a problem. There's a problem. How many times have you been to the movies or a play when you're kind of watching it and you really don't know what you're watching? Have anybody ever been there? And there are the other examples when you know too much. You go, oh, God. All right. And then when it's just right. And I was thinking in terms, have any of you seen Doubt? All right, it was a good movie. And within the first three setups of that movie, and when I say know about your characters, it isn't like they have to show their social security numbers or anything like that. It's just the Meryl Streep character as the father, I think it was Flanagan, was giving his talk. There's all these children talking. She's walking down the aisle. You don't even see her face. And she goes, poof. And you know enough about her. And then it finally settles. That's what I'm saying. So you say, who's that? I got to find out who that one is. And they're pulling you in very early on. And that would, I've never seen that script. But that's like the third, the movie opens up and they set the time frame. It's a period piece. And then they're in the church. So it had to be like the third scene in, fourth scene, maybe. What about The Wrestler? Anybody see that? Yeah. You got to watch cartoons after you see that movie. All right, then you'll have to trust me. It opens up with him doing what he does. He's in the ring, and then you find... So, same idea. You're pulled in. You know right off the bat what's going on with this guy. And then you say to yourself, you may, I've never been a wrestler, so what do I know about that? All right? But I do know something about being on the ropes and knowing people that have been on the ropes and they want to pull themselves out of whatever they're in. We all want change, don't we? I think. You know, we all want to make our lives better. So this guy happens to be a wrestler who's all drugged up. And I think Mickey Rourke was playing himself. But, it doesn't matter who. We're all can understand that. And now we're on the bus. We got in. We paid our money. We're on the bus with Mickey Rourke. And we're taking the journey. Let's think about one other one that's new. And then I could also talk about one that's old. And if you see The Reader, you guys have got to get out. That's true. Forget it. Here's the deal. The Reader starts off, I'm not going to tell you the whole story, but I have a problem with The Reader, and I'm going to tell you what it is. My problem with The Reader is the marketing. They market it like a Nazi movie. The Nazi thing is like, I said, oh, Nazis, I'm on board. Let's go, you know. Anything with Nazis, they're such great villains. The Nazi thing is there, but it's only an instrument to further the characters. It's not about her being a Nazi prison guard at all. I mean, she is, but it's really about how two people come together, without telling you the story, because you guys may want to see it. And think about this, if you may. I could actually pick a movie that we've all seen. I don't have to worry, but let me finish my point. How two characters can come together, and because they come together, it irrevocably changes their lives. So in the case of The Reader, that occurs. Now I'll give you. I'm not going to tell you how. You got to see it. But think about Titanic, the movie Titanic. The character that was written as Rose was getting married, and she was like a bird in a cage. And then she has that small relationship. I'm saying small because it's only a day and a half, and then, right? I mean, it wasn't like they were hanging out together for a long time. So the point is this. That's why I picked it. And she has an affair with him, you know, love affair, and he paints her picture and all that. But it's not about that. What it is about is that because they were together, she changed. And the very last scene, I remember reading the screenplay of that. You know when the camera, at the end of the movie, she throws the diamond in the water. I wouldn't have done that. But she throws the diamond in the water. What's that about? She could have moved to Boca or someplace. Anyway, she throws the thing in the water, and then she goes back, and she lays down. And I thought, is she dead? You know, does she throw it in there, and finally, and she's back together with everybody down there, or is she sleeping? And James Cameron wrote, you know, the camera pans slowly, and I'm not using his words, but you see all the pictures of her on the plane, on the horse, being in the theater. So what he's saying is, because of this relationship, this is what her whole life happened, and whether she's dead or sleeping is up to you. That's what I know he did say that. And he leaves it up to you. But I thought, two characters come together for a very short period of time, and in that part, they get a lot done. But it changes her life, her entire life. So in that sense, the medium, they wrote for the medium and the characters were effective within that framework. So these are the frames, the pitch, the script, the actual presentation. Now one other thing, when you're developing a character, let's go within the medium now. We talked about first 10 pages. What if you're writing for television? You're now writing for television. It's different. You don't have to do the whole job in the first 10 pages because most characters in television are a slow roll. So the biggest one, the hardest write for television, if it's series, is you're writing for the pilot. And you have this, think of this whole bucket of character traits. You don't use them all in the pilot. You take the most important ones and you encourage them. And in each subsequent episode, you add bits and pieces. So you have, theoretically, 26 episodes, if you're lucky, or 20, to create this character. And that's why people watch a television show and they get pulled in. And if you think of things like the medium, the medium is one. And what's the other one where the guy goes around?
The Mentalist.
I love that show. And it's like you find out little things about the character as you go. And in fact, sometimes the writers in a series change the character in the middle of the show. They say, we like this direction, and let's go in this direction, and let's not go in that direction. So that's a much slower roll. And then you could also be writing for, and why I mentioned it, because somebody mentioned they were on the Internet. What if you write for the Internet? So maybe your mode of transmission is now the Internet. You're not handing a script to anybody. You say, look at my 10 webisodes. So now you've got to think, I'm going to develop my character in that format, and it's like little pieces at a time. I'm not going to do episode 1 on total character. And so you slowly evolve it. So depending upon where you're rolling your character out, it's going to happen in a different way. What's the goal? The reader or the viewer, you want them to know more about your characters you can and to care about them. And so the hardest part, I think, in this transition from fiction to film is that in fiction, you're the only person writing. And when you get to the television medium or film medium, it becomes collaborative. And that's an issue. So that a star might read let's say you're fortunate enough to get your novel into the hands of Anthony Hopkins. And now he reads it, and you'll get it back with notes saying, this is what I'll do, I won't do this and that. And it's a collaboration, and you've got to be open to that. Even if they take your script, you write your novel, and now your script is totally done, and they take it, by the time it gets to a shooting script with lighting designers and stars, it's going to change. And you've got to make sure that the bottom line is this. You've got to be, it's like any relationship. You've got to give and take a little bit, but you've got to make sure that you don't lose your way. So that when they take your script, they don't make it into something else. You know, say, that's not what I wrote. Because ultimately, once they do that, one of my plays was done in Ohio. Is anybody here from Ohio? It was done in Dayton. And I got the reviews and got great reviews. And then the play was a play which was about a father and a daughter, an artist and a painter. And at the end of this thing, he breaks her hands. I mean, he does all sorts of bad stuff to her. And she still makes it. She becomes a world-renowned painter. In the very last scene in the film, he wants forgiveness. And she can't forgive him. She said, I understand you. I love you for what you are. I'm moving on. I'm okay. But you are not forgiven. What you did was not cool. And she, I didn't write it that way. It was better than that. And the producer of the play in Dayton said, oh, we can't have this. She's got a hug, and he goes off to Paris with her. And so here comes the review. Say, Catalano wrote a great thing, great imagery, but why such a Hollywood ending? I didn't write that. And I got nailed for it. Because I was on a skiing trip in Tahoe instead of being where I should have been. So the point of it is, you got to stay true to your core with your characters and everything like that, but you give and take. So you're writing now for, depending upon what you're doing, you have a reader or an audience, depending upon it, what it is, and you've got to give them some form of immediate gratification. And that's where that 10 pages comes in. You got to somehow create a hook within the beginning so that once they're on board, then you can roll out any way you want. How do you get this with character? In my other workshops, we talk about in writing, you have description, action, and dialogue. Essentially on the screen, that boils down to what they do, what they say, how they look, and what other characters say about them. Now, your character could say wonderful things about themselves. They could be liars, for all you know. You know, you got to find out the truth. But so, how do you describe your character? In that first 10 pages, we're assuming your character is having their initial entrance, right? So you got to describe them. In your novel, you spend a page and a half. Went to boarding school in France, you know, it was law, tell little anecdotes. You don't have that in a screenplay. You know, it's interior, a library day. Professor Muldoon walks slowly down the stairs, a crusty but benign college professor who... something or other. I can't think of it. I haven't had enough coffee. You get four lines. And that's it. That whole 2 pages of description of what he did at Harvard or Yale gets boiled down to crusty but benign whatever that Anthony Hopkins is playing or whatever. Wow, I should write this down. And you say, now let's talk about that, shall we? In your novel, you go, I got this description, man. When you read this thing, you're going to know who this guy is inside and out. Now you go to your screenplay and you say, oh, I got to get 120 pages. Interior library day, Professor Muldoon, old guy, walks downstage. You don't want to strip everything out of it, but you must capture the essence of your full description in your book. You must keep the book soul alive. And so you get that 50-word or 100-word description, and you boil it down to 5. And that's the challenge. You just don't, you know, there's so many people who are good soldiers. I think we talked about that. They go, oh, I'm going to write my screenplay, I'm going to do a good job, and I do it, and here it is, it's 100 pages, and it has no life. You must keep the life. So you struggle to make sure you get in those 5 or 8 or 10 words, those 2 lines of description, you don't lose any calories. It's got to stay the same, you know, basically. So the first thing you get is description. The next thing you could have is action, how they move in the space. And you could use words. You don't have to be like he walked slowly and put 1 foot after another. You don't have to do that. But if there's something interesting about how they do something, you would want to indicate that. If there's some sort of interesting action that they do, you could indicate that and but you do it on the fly while they do it. You don't do it up in the description. You do it on the fly. It's depending upon how they came in. You remember Columbo? You know, you would want to put a little of that in there. And that made Columbo interesting by the way he fumbled through things. There was a fumbling quality to him. And people go, this guy's a total dork. But meanwhile, he fumbled his way to solve every single crime. Or if you're writing Sherlock Holmes, it's the flip side. It's the Victorian side. It's Holmes is very, you know, formal, but he's looking at everything. And so all of those actions come into play. So action is important because it says something about your character that makes them interesting. And we could go through all sorts of things in describing that. It could be your character in the first 10 pages or 11 pages, their relationship with another character. We were doing this in the improv thing. 10? That fast?
Yeah.
You sure?
Yeah.
We were both improvising, and I'm from New York. I'm from L.A. now, but I'm from New York. And you know those people in New York on the subways when they're on the train, and you know they're like this, and they're like it's this far away. It's not a problem. You try and do that in L.A. I was saying, I was online at Rite Aid, and some guy kept breathing on me and pressing against my butt, trying to get the line to move faster. And that was a violation. So the definition of space in Los Angeles, in Ohio, I don't know, is different than in New York, Tokyo, Paris. And so that says something about how your character moves, and that may be 10 lines of description from your novel, just by creating that simple description of them doing something and how they do it, okay, says so much about the character and makes them compelling and interesting within that first 10 pages that the people want to know more about what you're doing. So action is very important and how it relates to other characters. The other thing that's important is, of course, dialogue. And we spent a whole ton of time on dialogue this morning. And dialogue is important because it's how a character, one of the ways, it's not the only way, a character communicates all the stuff you need to know. So does your character have a dialect? And if so, how do you convey that? Do you write it directly or do you put spoken Hungarian dialect? No, you try and do that as much as you can. And how they speak, do they speak in short sentences, like you talking to me? You said, I'm funny. What do you mean by funny? Like funny like a clown? Like I'm here to amuse you? Okay? That's one way of doing it. Or do they speak in long-winded speeches? And how do you fit that in to what you're trying to accomplish? Like my brother, you can ask him one thing and he'll go off like an hour and a half on it. So I don't want to ask him anything, you know? How was your day? Well, I got up and I brushed my teeth, and after that, I said, no, please. Is that your character? So you got how they speak is very important, and how they relate. So that when you finally finish this entrance of your main character, we're talking about, I'm assuming in your first 10 pages, you're going to have to answer, your main character's got to be in there, right? So your character walks in, and I don't know, we were doing Sopranos before, I'm dressed for it today. So your character walks in and goes, hey, how you doing? Right? And he's leading with a body part. I acted that badly, I know. But you notice that I hunched over a little bit and I'm leading with my chest like I'm some Goomba guy. Right? And what if I'm now an attorney? So now the attorney becomes more upright. It's, how you doing today? Everything fine? And the body language is here. It's none of this chin or thing. So it's little stuff like that. Why do you want to put that in there? Because then more of what you do in this novel gets brought over, but with less space. So you keep the Hannibal Lecter's quality. You keep your character's quality. You don't lose it, but it's compressed in what they move and what they say and how they move in the space and how they react. And guess what? All of those things are visual. You've gone from an intellectual, you know, where people are using their imaginations, to a visual medium. So you wouldn't say, like, the character walks in leading his chin and right foot and doing... No, you just say he kind of walked in leading with his chest like some... You do some sort of metaphor, which kind of gets it all compressed into one. And the cinematographer and the actor and the director can see it, and then they interpret it, and then they move from that point. It's never going to be exact, but at least the spirit of your work will remain. And that's what you want to try and get to. The ultimate thing, I think, is that you want to put your characters in introduce them in an interesting way. And the other thing, now look, this is a plot thing. It's not a character thing. I love to put my characters in peril as soon as possible. Make them fall, make the reader or the viewer or whatever fall in love, and then put them in trouble. And then you have the whole script to get them out of it. So it's like they're getting on a plane. we talked about yesterday. And we don't know why. And all of a sudden you cut to a train pulling in and whatever the story is. But you put them in peril. And I know it works because when I was driving here, there was a car accident and people always want to stop and see how it's, you know, are there any heads rolling around on the floor? What's going on? I know somebody who owns a car like that. There's all different kinds of things. We're pulled into it. And that's what I think is the most important thing. I know so many writers who are not good, but they're so good at selling. You know, they get their ideas and they hook people in and then the delivery is crap. But they go, hey, I've already spent all this time on this thing. I guess I might as well see what happened. I was watching last night while all you guys were out partying. I went to bed early. And they had that 48 hours about the Navy guy and the wife. Did any of you see it? And it was a very compelling story. She married him and then he died, you know, and everybody, and then they found arsenic in his body and she went to jail. It was a long story. But there was something very compelling about this young family coming together and I watched it. I never watched that show. I was interested in it just to see how it would turn out. Whether, you know, however. And that's what you've got to do in that first 10, 11, however many pages. I want you to know that, how am I doing? Another? I'm coming down the track. All right. I want you to know that no one's going to sit there and go, oh, you almost had me, but you did it on page 11. I'm sorry. No. All I'm saying is it's in the front end of your script. Don't roll out the most important thing at the intermission. You know, it's got to be right up front. That's the world that we live in today. Everybody wants it right away. And if you could do it, I mean, some writers, they do it on the first page. And I'm sure in your novel classes, they talk about writing your first page when they open up the book and they go, wow, you know, I'm going to buy this book. It's like that, but it's a little bit different because in film, television, it's visual. So when you go to a meeting, if you get your screenplays bought, you have your first director's meeting, you're going to sit there and the director's going to say weird stuff. He's going to say, or she's going to say, let me see, let me go over this. How can I show this story? And I said, is that right? Don't you want to tell the story? No, it's show. It's all visual. And they literally take your script and they block it up like a mosaic of visual setups. And they put them in a line if it's a narrative story. And they see how is this going to look on the screen? How are we going to show it? And so in your first 10 pages, if you're getting a reader, you want to be able to hook those people with wonderful characters, visually interesting, and the choices you make, I should say, I'm picking up my speed here, the choices that you make have to be interesting. So if there are things that are mundane about your character, either let them go or bring them in later on. You want to heighten this. You want to serve the best part of the meal first. Get them hooked. And then, I'm not saying your work is not good in the back end, but then you'll be allowed to tell your story. If you don't get them up in the front, you'll never get the opportunity to tell your story. Thank you very much. You've been a great audience. Thank you. Any questions, anybody?